Initiate switch. Actuate it counterclockwise.
The United States, technically not at war with any nation, but that doesn't mean our defense is dormant.
The U.S. has agreed to almost double its number of military bases in the Philippines.
How many countries does the United States have military bases in?
It's mind-blowing when you think about this.
Should the United States be the world's policeman?
Have we ever tried to meddle in other countries' elections?
Oh, probably.
This is an American $1 bill. A green piece of paper, a specific blend of linen and cotton, stamped and numbered. And in most places around the world, it represents one thing and one thing only. The terrifying might of the most powerful state in all of human history. A military force unrivaled by the next 10 combined. A colonial power with territorial holdings throughout the Western Hemisphere. And an economic titan capable of controlling resources and the flow of money in just about every corner of the world. This is the story of the American Empire. Hey gang, Second Thought is a 100% grassroots-funded operation. We don't get sponsors here, we make principled anti-capitalist content, and so the only way these videos get made is through the generous support of viewers like you. So if you like the content we're making, please consider supporting us on Patreon.com. You can find us at Patreon.com/Second Thought, and you get tons of cool perks while you're at it, including early access to videos, access to our patrons-only Discord with thousands of members. It's a great place to hang out. We hope to see you there. Okay, so most of us grew up with this map of the U.S. 48 contiguous states on a big sheet of paper with two little notches for the islands of Hawaii and Alaska somewhere in the corner. It's a map that's meant to tell us what the U.S. is, and the map says that this, well, this is pretty much all there is. But that's not true. Hold on, let me show you. I have some other maps. Here's what I mean. When you look at maps like these, they make it immediately obvious what you're looking at. Empires. States that exert power over their subordinate geographies and the people who live there. States that expand over time, often overseas, to quash their new imperial holding sovereignty, either through territorial annexation, military pressure, economic extraction, direct political control, or usually, all four of those at once. Most of us don't really see the US the same way. During the 20th century, we saw basically every existing empire, the British, the French, the Dutch, the Portuguese, shrink dramatically when colonized people on just about every continent fought for their independence. Since then, there's been a general feeling that we just don't live in an age of empires anymore. And we have maps, like this one, or this one over here, that show the US as a contained, mostly isolated blob to back that up. But maps like these lie. They conceal and minimize the true extent of American power. They hide its true nature as more of an empire than a typical country. So in this video, I want to shed some much-needed light on the three main ways that the U.S. became the global empire that it is today. Its literal colonies, its military, and the central role that it's come to occupy in the global economy. Let's start with the colonial territory of the U.S., because this is probably the most obvious and overlooked aspect of the American empire. Now, the U.S. started as a settler colony right off the bat. Most of us are familiar with America's expansion from the original British colonies in the east going west to cover this whole area we know today.
Building westward.
In the process, displacing and genociding the native populations that stood in the way. Millions of people were killed, and millions of acres of land had to be stolen and resettled by American colonists to form the borders that we're all familiar with. But it didn't stop there. To go global, this project of manifest destiny had to start extending beyond the physical borders of North America. And that process created a U.S. that looks very different from what you usually think of. Here, take a look at this map. This used to be called the Greater U.S. And this is what it looks like when you isolate the American parts. Here you have, to a more accurate scale, the map we all know. The continental US, Alaska, and Hawaii are there, of course, but you also have the various territories under formal US control in 1941. Guam, American Samoa, the Philippines, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, the Pacific Outlying Islands, and the Caribbean Outlying Islands. Various territories with different legal statuses, most of which are still under U.S. rule today, with a few of them almost as large or as wide as the mainland. What's crazy about this map is, well, first, the fact that it shows what we usually think of as the U.S. as just one of many parts of a vast collection of territories. But also, it's crazy to think just how many people are actually represented here. Back in the 1940s, the inhabited territories outside the states had a combined population of 19 million people, meaning if you lived under the US's jurisdiction in any of the places on this map, there was about a 1 in 8 chance it wasn't here. But there's almost no chance that the rest of the population ever thought of things that way. Back in the 1940s, Americans on the mainland probably never regarded themselves as co-citizens with those living in US territories or thought of those places as American. To be fair, that's probably still true today for places like Guam or Puerto Rico. Not for any nefarious reasons necessarily, but because odds are that most Americans just wouldn't hear about them. According to Daniel Immerwahr, the author of How to Hide an Empire, the average mainland American in the 1930s was about twice as likely to hear about Brazil or Poland in the newspaper than a place like the Philippines, a territory with some 10 to 15 million people living under US rule. That's a very different reality than for those who lived in these US territories. You simply couldn't escape daily life under the empire and your secondary status within it. Occupation, colonization, or whatever it was called in your specific area usually meant saluting the Stars and Stripes, being forced to learn English and US history at school, using American dollars, and celebrating things like Thanksgiving. Most of the time, doing all of this without the same guarantees of constitutional rights as on the mainland, with little say in the government that dictates your daily life, and usually being subject to a lot of colonial violence to boot. Fast forward a bit, and this sort of territorial control expanded during World War II. Adding to the likes of Guam, American Samoa, and the Philippines, the US gained massive territorial holdings during the war by occupying parts of Germany, Korea, Japan, and Austria, for example. We don't usually think of these as territorial growth, but to give you an idea, at the end of 1945, there were more people living under American rule outside the mainland than within it. With the new occupations, 135 million people lived under US control, but weren't on the map that hangs in every classroom. It's not until very recently that this country stopped looking a lot like the British Empire. But things changed dramatically after World War II. After the war, two things happened. The US simultaneously decolonized and actually gave up a lot of occupied territory that it had acquired over the last century, but at the same time, while the highlighted areas on the map slowly faded and the US pulled back, the country's control over the world actually greatly increased as it calcified into a permanent, truly global military force. After the war, the US was standing at the summit of the world, according to Winston Churchill. Relatively unscathed compared to the destruction we saw in Europe and the overseas territories like the Philippines, the US, quote, made more goods, had more oil, held more gold, and possessed more planes than all other countries combined. It had one of the biggest militaries, controlled or occupied absurd amounts of land and people, and emerged on the winning side of the war without the same casualties as the USSR and the rest of the Allied forces. With its massive material wealth and million-strong army, the US could have easily done like every imperial power before it. Continue acquiring more territories, maybe even annex major European nations and their colonies, incredibly weak after the war, and establish a new, truly global empire on the scale of something like the British. But instead, the US did something surprising and gave up territory. Let go of the Philippines, stopped annexing new areas, gave up running entire countries, and even began echoing the Soviet Union's pro-decolonization rhetoric. Why? Well, for starters, socialist, nationalist, or otherwise decolonial movements in Asia and Africa made operating like the old empires just too costly for the West. Civil wars broke out, and countries were gaining independence almost everywhere you looked. In the face of this, fighting wars on dozens of fronts to set up new colonial administrations was not really an enticing future for US leadership when you can literally see the empires around you slowly losing their global dominance. Second, the emerging Cold War and the U.S.'s realignment against the USSR needed convincing rhetoric.
Yet we know that Russia today is regarded as a grave threat to our nation, to our freedom, to the peace of the world.
Anti-colonial movements under the European empires just wouldn't ally with the U.S. in its anti-communist project if they were going to be right back under a formal empire immediately after. Culturally, the USSR had successfully made anti-colonialism the moral high ground, and the U.S. couldn't argue the opposite and get organic support. Most importantly, though, the U.S. realized it just didn't need to be a formal empire and repeat old mistakes to reap imperial benefits. Why set up a colonial administration when a few bases and a little economic nudge would do? Look at this map. The first thing the U.S. did after formally releasing some of its colonies and choosing not to acquire any more was to set up a global system of military bases. While the U.S. already had a few of these set up, mostly in its own colonial holdings, the end of the war came with a huge boom in these installations around the world. Most surprisingly, outside of countries that the U.S. laid a formal claim to or had recently let go of. Today, the U.S. has around 800 bases all over the world. An approximate 173,000 troops are deployed in, we think, about 159 countries. None of these numbers are exact. We don't know for a fact every single base, airspace, lily pad, or other U.S. military installation out there, because a lot of that info is kept secret. According to Immerwahr's estimates, though, we can put these numbers in perspective. There are only about 30 overseas military bases not owned and operated by the U.S. in the entire world. Britain and France have 13, Russia has 9, and a few other countries have 1. Even if our numbers are way off, that's it for the rest of the world. There's just no comparison with the 800 sites the U.S. maintains globally. So, how did this happen? See, the U.S. didn't quite handle decolonial negotiations in total fairness, or in line with its professed ideals of championing democracy around the world. Sure, it left the Philippines without much of a fight, but reconstruction came with a price. The country would agree to a few U.S. military bases strategically placed near the countries it wanted to keep an eye on. Sure, Hawaii was granted statehood, but in exchange, the island of Koho-Olawe was almost entirely turned over for military use as a training facility and gun range. Sure, citizens of Guam got more rights and citizenship after the war, but now, over a quarter of the island is used for military bases today. Same goes for countries like Japan, Germany, and South Korea, who were all occupied by the U.S. in some capacity and got the same treatment. They all have somewhere around 100 bases each today. Let's zoom out for a second and just imagine if the U.S. experienced the same treatment. Imagine if tomorrow, foreign military forces, say from enemy states like China or Russia, were stationed all over the country or at various points near the border. It's probably not a comfortable idea. And for most countries out there, it's unfortunately the norm. And there's a point to the U.S. having this kind of reach. These American bases all over the world serve a purpose. For countries with smaller militaries, these bases keep them surrounded. For our allies, American bases near or in their major cities keep these countries in line. These permanent sites with sometimes 100-year-long leases can serve many purposes for the U.S. They can easily be used either as a place to keep nuclear weapons pointed outwards, a central location for spying operations, or just a home for boots on the ground to protect nearby points of interest like oil wells in foreign nations that are supposed to be sovereign. In complete contradiction with the official messaging that says they're there to spread democracy or ensure peace, bases, unsurprisingly, often prompt the states they surround into ramping up their own military spending, increasing the threat of war in the process. In some cases, these bases simply serve as protection for the despots the U.S. is aligned with, a permanent reminder that the U.S. is just a step away if people start rising up against their government. Overall, these installations are there to keep these countries, basically every country on Earth with a base within or near its borders, in line with American corporate interests, preventing them from making sovereign decisions about what American politicians like to call our oil interests here in the U.S. Finally, these bases can also serve as the command center for disinformation campaigns. Take Swan Island, for example. During the 60s, the CIA ran a covert radio station out of these islands in the Caribbean. Posing as a private radio station, the agency blasted Cuba, the rest of the Caribbean, and a huge chunk of Latin America, something like 50 million listeners, with propaganda against Fidel Castro and the Cuban government. On Radio Swan, you could hear false news reports and even homophobic statements about politicians like Raúl Castro, as the CIA used every method available to instigate a coup against the first Cuban government to have successfully kicked out American corporations. Corporations that, for decades, had enriched themselves off Cuba's sugar plantations and oil refineries while keeping the country's working people in a state of abject poverty under a US-backed puppet government. On a related note, these bases can also be used as launching points for invasions and wars at a moment's notice, or serve as coordination sites for foreign interference. Here again, the US is unmatched on the global stage. Since 1991, the US has launched over 250 military interventions by its own admission and made over 350 coup attempts since 1982. If any of this feels outdated or from a different era, like the Cold War, here's John Bolton, former National Security Advisor in 2022.
One doesn't have to be brilliant to attempt a coup.
I disagree with that. As somebody who has helped plan coup d'etat,
yeah,
not here, but you know, other places, it takes a lot of work. And that's not what he did.
When we were talking about what is capable, what you need to do to be able to plan a coup, and you cited your expertise having planned coups.
I'm not going to get into the specifics.
And here's James Woolsey, former CIA director in 2018.
Under their wing.
Have we ever tried to meddle in other countries' elections?
Oh, probably, but it was for the good of the system in order to avoid the communists from taking over. For example, in Europe in 47, 48, 49, the Greeks and the Italians, we
don't do
CIA.
That now, though. We don't mess around other people's elections, Joe.
Only for a very good
Can
cause.
Can you do that? Do a Vine video on those former CIA directors.
Only for a very good cause in the interests of democracy.
All right, thanks for being here. It's always great.
This actually neatly transitions into the last pillar of American imperialism abroad, economic power. Since World War II, the global economy has been absolutely dominated by the US. Part of that is because the GDP of this country is massive. A lot of trade happens between the US and other countries. But that's only a small, declining part of the full-scale economic power of the US. Once again, after World War II, the US, along with the IMF and the World Bank, two institutions in which the US is the only country with veto power, by the way, went to work opening countries up to American money. Coups and territorial/military expansion weren't enough. Through policies like the Marshall Plan in Europe and conditional loans in the Global South demanding countries reduce their government spending and sell off their assets to American corporations, the US fashioned a global order in which American capital, much like the American military, could freely move in and out of most countries. While people are mostly stuck within their borders, American capitalists can now freely buy up assets or set up factories wherever they please. Meaning, wherever workers are the cheapest, labor laws are the weakest, and natural resources are the least well defended. All of that without needing to set up any official colonial government, just signing a couple free trade treaties and letting American money do the talking. This unprecedented access to the resources and wealth of other countries means that, by 2012, American companies owned 46% of all publicly listed shares of the top 500 corporations in the world. For a country representing about 4% of the world's population, this gives American CEOs unrivaled power and control over the wealth produced globally. And this is only compounded by the fact that since 1971, the US replaced the global gold standard with the American dollar. See, to participate in the global economy today, you pretty much need US dollars, particularly if what you're trying to buy is oil, which pretty much every country wants and is priced against the dollar. While countries can sometimes trade in their own currencies with some reciprocity, it often isn't possible to supply all your needs without using dollars. And this means that most countries' central banks are forced to add dollars to their international reserves if they want to have access to the outside world. Many countries are now, therefore, deeply embedded in American monetary policy, whether they want to be or not, allowing the US's ability to create new money or tweak interest rates to dictate massive chunks of the global economy in its favor with a single keystroke. And if all this wasn't enough, the final way the US flexes its economic power is through sanctions. Here again, nobody is on the US's level. Today, 1/3 of all nations and around 60% of all poor countries now face some form of US sanctions. In total, the US has some 15,000 active sanctions, 3 times as many as the next country and breaking all historical records. This, and the fact that so much trade happens in dollars, means that denying access to the dollar, like many sanctions do, can completely cripple countries. Not just their economies, like we often hear it reported on the news. Sanctions, while often seeming much less dramatic than war, can be just as, if not more, brutal for average people's livelihoods. The 60-year embargo on Cuba, for example, has meant that any company or country that wishes to trade with Cuba risks facing sanctions of their own. Faced with the choice between the massive market of the US and the tiny island of Cuba, most companies make the sensible decision. The consequence of almost everybody cutting Cuba off this way puts millions of lives at risk. And that's on purpose. In the US government's own words, the sanctions are there to, quote, decrease monetary and real wages, to bring about hunger and desperation in the hopes that enough suffering will mean a coup against the Communist Party of Cuba. You already know that it hasn't worked. It's just meant people die without access to food, water, or medicine that is plentiful just outside the country's borders. Everywhere you look, this map just feels inadequate. Sandwiched between two other countries on a continent far away from Africa, Asia, and Europe, the US looks small. It fades into the jigsaw puzzle of borders and ocean fronts. It doesn't seem like much. But this is not what the US is. It's this, and this, and this, an empire. An empire that has overstayed its welcome around the world. An empire that casually destroys millions of lives because it makes them money. Empires always make the same mistakes. And eventually, every empire falls.